Accession number 28459, reel 3.
He's reel 10.
And Monty was the deputy secure. And when I'd been in Malta, I had gone on a visit to the NATO's one annual big exercise. And Monty had given a strategic overview. And it was, without any question of doubt, the best and most astonishingly perceptive speech I've ever heard from anybody on the military scene. Quite incredible. But we'll talk about that level. And though the Brits, their influence waned as time went on. And the other thing that disappeared, of course, with NATO was that even when I was there in the early 60s, there was a threat. Cuba occurred while I was there. The possibility of a Russian nuclear attack was very real. And if you have a threat, people tend to keep together in order to respond to the threat. I mean, it's an aside from what we're talking about, but I think, I don't know how NATO has survived this long, except that it exists, and nobody wants to get rid of something in which you've got whatever it is, 15 nations, all working together. But they haven't got a threat now. Nobody's going to threaten NATO. What happens is you have a little uprising in Kosovo or something, and they say the Germans won't go because they don't want to send their troops out of the country. It's something like that. So it's much more difficult.
So, could I ask you to break down your job into perhaps a few more basic, to a more basic level? So,
a danger?
Yeah.
Well, there was a morning briefing. I had a little cell consisting of an American yeoman, that's to say a sort of petty officer equivalent, and a Dutchman, Dutch commander. And we were the naval cell in shape, this vast beast. And we got reports in about, you know, a Russian cruiser coming through the Dardanelles or something like that. And there would be submarine reports. And we had links out to the naval headquarters in Northwood and places like that.
So all intelligence from all the NATO countries would come to you.
That's right. Naval intelligence.
Naval intelligence.
But it was part of an intelligence branch, which was headed by a British general, who was an intelligence expert, and there were all these representatives of the other nations, a sprinkling of Air Force, mostly Army. And they included Germans, Norwegians, Danes.
So it was mostly probably Soviet intelligence about Soviet.
Oh, yes, exclusively. I mean, because nobody else was threatening us, anybody. We would turn up 9 o'clock, day's work, go through the papers, have some lectures. We would have a morning prayers, morning briefing for the intelligence thing, and I would give a little spiel about the naval situation such as it was. And it was a very relaxed existence. We had a lot of time to do other things. And I spent quite a lot of time socialising. One of the oddest thing I undertook, because my predecessor, who was also a fluent French speaker, had done, was to run the Shapes annual lottery at the Shape Ball, which they held in Versailles. And that was quite a big affair, because there was always a car for the first prize that one of the French companies was persuaded to give in. And there were some fairly lavish prizes. And there was a lot of money floating around, and it all went to some charity for disabled Greek veterans or something like that. I can't remember what. But anyway, I ran that. And Mrs. Sacure, Mrs. Norstadt, won the second prize. And I was held as being absolutely out of court for having allowed such a thing to happen. It never occurred to anybody it might be straight, but because it was felt that I was carrying favour. And as the second prize was a mink stole, it was quite substantial. And, well, there you are.
Well, what happened to the intelligence that came through?
What happened to him? God knows. Don't quote that. It was part of all the information that went into Sackler's office, but the whole thing was overlaid with a very strong political input. I mean, Sackler, who was always an American, we had a wonderful chap called Laurie Norstad, and they had another army chap called, I can't remember, but he was a parachutist, and he was sort of gung-ho army man who went around killing everybody. Totally uncivil. He got drummed out of the job. But it all formed part of the great thing, the great mass of information, the basis for NATO's existence. And once a year, you had the great NATO exercise, and everybody was involved. And we used to go down to some enormous caves which existed just outside Paris, where they had their headquarters. I think they probably would have been proof against atomic attack. And we actually used to work for a week, 24 hours round the clock. You get home to sleep, but otherwise you were on duty for 24 hours. It always used to work, and people did turn up, and they did work. There was a lot of difficulty getting people to accept the ingrained attitudes, for example, of the Americans or the Brits, which were quite often at variance, and the French, who decided that they would pack the whole thing in but keep a presence there. But these are all problems quite outside the normal run of the mill. And because there was nothing actually operational going on, except on paper, the only thing that kept the thing together, in my opinion, was the threat. I don't know quite how it stands together now, because there are other political... There's European Union, there's politics, providing an overriding sort of knitting together influence.
After you had completed your time there, where did you go after that?
After that...
Looking at the form that you filled in, it seems as if you did that prior to going to Latimer. Would that be right?
Possible. Quite possible. No, I don't think I did. No, put it wrong on the football. Now, after that, I went to an outfit in the ministry. I hadn't had a ministry job since I was in the appointments branch, and I went to the main building. And I went to a job in an outfit called DNTWP, which was the Director of Naval Tacticals and Weapons Policy. And I had the carrier desk for the building of the new big carriers, which were the part of a tremendous battle with Dennis Healy as the defence minister between the RAF and the Navy, because these carriers were going to be very, very costly, but they had to replace the carriers, and the RAF had a replacement aircraft called the TSR-2, and there were the most tremendous battles in the middle of which I was. Anyway, I did that for a couple of years, and then I got a lovely consolation prize. I was talked about influence before, and a term mate of mine was the naval secretary, and he is a chap who appoints captains. And because of my time at Latimer, he asked me if I'd be interested in becoming the deputy director of the War College at Greenwich as a captain, as an acting captain. And so I said, yes, please.
And what did that involve?
Oh, that involved doing a staff course, running a staff course, in the Naval College of Greenwich, and for senior officers. And it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, it was a lovely job.
What were you teaching them?
Oh, we were teaching them politics, with a military slant, about one another. We dealt with the problems of the world. in a lovely broad sense in which you could say anything, get away with it. We would travel to Berlin, and we would travel to Paris, and we would have a week in each place, and we didn't get across the Atlantic. Even bigger, better staff course for that. My wife actually did it in a previous existence. And, well, anyway, it was a lovely job. And one would have every day a lecture from some high-priced chap, ranging from Dennis Healy to airmen, sailors, soldiers, politicians, professors of IT, and but not the least, most interesting aspect of it was that, like all staff courses, you start off with 3 or 4 weeks on a sort of mind-broadening exercise, in which, because you've been incarcerated and imbued with the spirit of, you know, your commander, your command, or your company, or your squadron, or your ship, you need to expand people. So after we'd had 4 weeks of this, we would go off somewhere. We used to go to university. And we went to different universities in town. The first time that I was there, having come to this cold, not having done the course, we went to St. Catherine's in Cambridge. And for the first time in my life, I realized there was something I'd missed. And I wish to goodness I'd been to university. I loved it. It was just wonderful. And I could go, I'm too late in the day now, but I wouldn't mind doing that.
Still the Open University.
Oh, no, it's too much like hard work.
So, what was the purpose of this course, if I could ask you to summarise it?
Yeah, good question again. You've been doing this job too long, I think. The purpose of the course was to provide a staff course, an intermediate staff course, above the single service staff courses which each of them ran, which are very important for promotion, especially in the army. The joint services staff courses, which were sort of commander's level, and the defence college course, which is for senior captains and admirals, which involves a lot of worldwide travelling and generally sort of familiarisation with things going on, people, individuals, and policies at a higher level, strategic and political. This was sort of interim thing. The Navy was the only course that had it, and I've never quite known how the Navy got away with it. It was called the SOWC. It was known disrespectfully as the golf course, but it wasn't quite like that. It was, I think, well, of course, I would say that, but it was valuable, and it was a jolly good course, and we did get the benefit of listening to some wonderful people talking to us and telling us quite a lot of things.
What happened to you after that?
After that, I was on my way. I didn't quite know what to do. My wife was getting quite ill, and I wanted a job in which I could be at home, away from home. So I elected to become a positive vetter. That meant that I could work from home. So I did that for 2 years. I retired after the... I did the first bit as a commander again, and then when I retired, aged 50, in 1971, I stayed on as a civil servant and did the same job. And positive vetting, I'm sure you know all about. Because you don't.
I don't.
Well, positive vetting is a form of vetting for people who are supposed to be having access to particularly sensitive material. It's not by any means the highest form of vetting, but it is fairly high. And so there are certain jobs down to all levels, which...
Is this within the civil service or within the military?
Oh, within the Navy. And but you can interview people outside it. And the interviewers, which I was one, go around and interview the people themselves, and they interviewed two referees for each person and a succession of officers or people who've been reporting officers throughout their careers to find out various sort of things. Time marches on, so I don't know whether the standards are the same. One of the things we were always on the lookout for was somebody who had displayed any homosexual traits. I don't imagine that's not quite so much on the cards now, but it certainly was then. But there, you know, it was private life, reliability, trying to assess whether people were likely to give the game away. Actually, it's a highly questionable activity. I can see you've got to vet people. But looking back on it, the thing is, do people really tell you the truth? I doubt it. Because I think there are things in people's lives that everybody wants to not talk about. But all I can say is that I asked a great many chaps, one of the questions, standard question was, have you ever committed adultery? And it was only the people who said no that I was suspicious of.
Is there anything else that you would like to
I think I've talked
add?
Quite enough.
And
actually, I think I will say something. I had about when one considers to go right back to the beginning, how I came to join the Navy. I've had a superbly interesting, entertaining, and rewarding life. It's not been tremendously successful, but it's certainly not been without interest. And I've had marvellous time.
I know that, one thing I should ask you, I know that you, towards the end of your career, you sort of slipped seamlessly almost into civil service betting, or betting for daily within civil service context. Did you actually miss being part of the Navy?
Actually, I don't think I did. I have never been a great reunion man. And reunions are things that service chaps tend to want and do. The only reunion that I attend, I've attended the odd squadron reunion from the Pacific, but the only reunion that I attend regularly, I think we've had a last one now, there's so few of us left, was something that that the term back from Dartmouth started after the war. And I used to go to those, and the rapport, if you like, the camaraderie, which exists after 3.5 years together at Dartmouth in your formative years, is not something to be denied. And even though people have all gone different directions, it is really like turning the clock back, just like that, if you meet up with them. But otherwise, no. The fact that one is tied up with one's family, one's wife, and if she's not well, which she wasn't then, and she died 20 years ago, 25 years ago, is... you know, you have other things to worry about. That had the priority at the time. Now I've got another one.